Hi, I'm Tim Shank, a host of Booked. You're listening to my interview today with K. Sabeel Rahman, author of Democracy Against Domination, a really powerful investigation of what he argues is a lost strain of democratic political thought that emerged in the United States at the end of the 19th century and flourished for a brief period of time, receded, and now could not be more relevant in the age not just of Obama, but of Trump that we're about to enter into. Thank you, Sabeel, for coming.
Thanks very much, Tim. Glad to be here.
There's a lot to discuss, obviously. All right, so let's dive in. You start the book off with Barack Obama, victory night, January 2008, after the Iowa caucuses. Why start there?
I start with that vignette to highlight a couple of things about the core themes of the book, which is, you know, the book at its heart, I think, is really about this question of what progressivism really means in a rapidly changing, highly unequal economy. And the Obama election really fused two big things that were happening around the same time. The first was this a seemingly transformative figure who was reshaping the Democratic Party, reshaping progressive politics in the course of his own candidacy. Mm-hmm. But as that was happening, trouble was brewing in the economy already that spring. Had the first waves of what would then later become the big financial crisis, the meltdown that culminated in the fall of Lehman Brothers in September. And so by the time the 2008 election was over, we had a new president who sort of ran on a platform of reinvigorating government, making it more responsive to the people. At the same time, we had a total collapse of our financial system, leading to the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. So that convergence of an attempt to remake our democracy, so if we take Obama's argument on its face of what his candidacy was about, and this crisis of the economy, put in stark terms the challenge for what I think 21st century progressivism is facing. And so the book is really an attempt to step back a little bit from that moment and think about historically and normatively and institutionally, what does a 21st century progressivism look like in light of those two challenges.
And the way that you do that is really you step back quite a bit historically and cast your gaze backward to a little bit the Gilded Age, but really the Progressive Era. And you argue that there's a sort of like untapped pool of like political thought, institution building, all sorts of potential resources that we could draw upon for thinking through the challenges that we face today. Before we dive into that history, though, I think we should just get clear about what exactly like the landscape is, like where you're surveying right now. It seems like the key divide in this book, or like your assessment of where we are at this moment, which can help explain what was lost along the way, but where we are right now is divided between two main approaches to economic governance. The first you call managerial, the second you call laissez-faire. Can you put a little flesh on those concepts?
Yeah, so I think in our kind of common parlance, we're used to thinking about economic governance questions in these two terms as really a battle between free markets, sort of laissez-faire, conservative, libertarian ideas, and an appeal to kind of government, you know, liberal big government, however you want to think about it. And in the book, I go into the political theory of these two ideas a little bit deeper. And so I think the laissez-faire argument, you know, it's not just a rank, you know, everything government does is wrong. If you actually sort of look at it historically and normatively, there is a real theory there.
Yeah, you have a lot of respect for the laissez-faire position.
I take it really seriously, and I think there's a lot. There is a lot there, and to my mind, it has to do with this idea of accountability. The market as a system is, in the laissez-faire vision, a way of ensuring that the economy works towards the public good and preventing concentrations of unaccountable power, right?
Because that's where the state is the enemy, because that can be co-opted by private interests and used to like hinder the public good.
Totally. And you see this, you know, in the political theory of figures like Hayek and Friedman, mm-hmm. But you also see it, interestingly, in the history of laissez-faire thought in law and public policy. So if you go back the sort of Lochner era in American legal
history. So that's turn of the 20th century, high Gilded Age trickle.
Exactly. Turn of the century. This is when you have a similar moment of economic upheaval, industrialization. People are trying to figure out what's the role of government in a new economy. And laissez-faire legal thought at that time is really resistant to things like the minimum wage or labor unionization. But one of the arguments that they, or chief argument that they advance, you see in the court cases, is this idea that laissez-faire market structures are resistant to capture by particular interests, and that's why you want a sort of self-correcting market system. There's all sorts of reasons why you might think that was maybe not, those arguments were not always offered in good faith,
yeah,
right?
among others, that they can be remarkably self-interested.
Right, right. And that, you know, I don't want to downplay that at all, but I think intellectually there is this idea that we have a deep concern about the accountability and responsiveness of public politics, and if we don't address that concern, you know, that's part of what gives a laissez-faire argument its hook into persuasiveness.
So there's a real, like, democratic justification for a kind of laissez-faire perspective.
Right, exactly. And then I think once you have that interpretation of the laissez-faire argument, that then casts into relief some of the limitations of the conventional sort of liberal argument that appeals to what I call managerialism.
Which emerges over the course of the 20th century as the chief rival to this laissez-faire vision.
Right. So you know, managerialism is, I think, what we now most commonly associate with liberal progressive politics, especially after the New Deal, this idea that the way we respond to problems in the market, problems in the economy, is by setting up government institutions. But those institutions are, in order to make sure that they serve the public good, are very much top-down and expert-based. So think the Federal Reserve, right? We're not going to leave the market to its own devices. We need some way of making sure it actually works for everyone. But our way of doing that is basically giving a lot of power and insulation to really smart experts who are going to tinker with the system to make it work really well. And so that's a managerial idea. There's a history to that, and there's some value to that. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't really speak, I don't think, to that underlying concern about power, accountability, democracy that really was underlying some of the laissez-faire critique, but also very underlying the historical debates about the role of government in that earlier period.
And so this is that third tradition that gets lost, that democratic tradition. So can you talk about that more?
Right, great. So if you look at the history sort of pre-New Deal, where, you know, the technocratic, managerial ideas of government are starting to emerge, the laissez-faire argument is on the table, but there was this sort of third strain, which I draw out in the book, and you see this in figures like Louis Brandeis, who eventually became Supreme Court Justice, but who was sort of labor legal movement lawyer.
Very influential on Woodrow Wilson.
Influential on Woodrow Wilson in that 1912 campaign, and continued to be a big figure in progressive politics, both before and after. I see it in people like John Dewey, the legal realists like Robert Hale and Morris Cohen and so on.
But it does seem like Brandeis and Dewey are sort of like the conscience of the book.
Yeah, Brandeis and Dewey are the real touchstones for the book, in part because I think there are lots of different theories of government that were emerging during this time. I think Brandeis and Dewey in particular really gravitated towards the moral value of democracy. And in their work, I see an attempt to think through what that looks like institutionally. So on this third tradition, in contrast to the managerial and the laissez-faire idea, the democratic critique, on the one hand, takes seriously the problem of private power. So like the managerial view, it is wise to the fact that free markets aren't free, and you need some way of checking economic power. But interestingly, like the laissez-faire idea, it also takes seriously the idea that sort of government on its own is not guaranteed to serve the public good, that you need to structure government in ways that are deeply democratically responsive. And what I see in Dewey and Brandeis is it was an attempt to think through what that means in practice. And that's the reservoir of ideas and experimentation that I think is we really need to bring back as we're thinking about 21st century progressive politics.
One of the things I love most about this book is that you approach these, as a historian, I'm biased on this, but you approach these questions sort of with a deep historical background, but unlike many historians, you don't get lost in the details and the minutiae. You're very clear, like, these are the important, like, lines I want to follow. You don't sort of favor these individuals for the sake of reconstructing their thought. You're tracking sort of really big concepts over a long period of time here, which is admirable, and which allows me to ask a question like the one I'm about to, which is, so you have this third tradition, this democratic tradition. It's not as if people have never heard of Brandeis or Dewey. Certainly, like, Dewey is, like, cited often in, like, ubiquitously in a variety of disciplines, academic disciplines today. So how exactly is this tradition, like, forgotten? If it was once so powerful, if it's embraced by one of the most influential legal thinkers of his generation, arguably the most influential philosopher of his generation, how can you argue that it disappears?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I say, as someone who, you know, is not trained as a historian but loves working with intellectual history, I especially appreciate that that the historical parts of the argument sort of resonated.
No, it's great. You get to read the cool books, but you don't have to go to the archives. Oh,
it's the best of both worlds. Absolutely, as a political theorist, getting to kind of parachute in and out of some of these different debates. But I do think there's a really important arc here of how we go from the era of Brandeis to the modern era. And in the book, I kind of frame it as going through these two or three important transformations or phases. The first transformation is through the course of the New Deal. And so in a lot of ways...
Which Brandeis has a very conflicted relationship to say the least.
Well, exactly. And I think that's indicative. So in a lot of ways, the New Deal does sort of realize some of the substantive policy aspirations of progressive era thought, including some Deweyan and Brandeisian notions, for example, creating institutions to regulate monopolies and antitrust, setting up just a social safety net, labor bargaining and the Wagner Act. There's lots of things that come to fruition in the New Deal. But what's distinctive and important about the New Deal is by the time the New Deal ends, it puts into place a particular view of what institutions are needed to respond to the problems of market power. And that view rests on this idea of expertise. So James Landis, who, drafts the bill creating the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, and then later is the commissioner for it, part of FDR's brain trust. He is a disciple of Brandeis's. But his take on the governance question is that you needed technocratic expert bodies because traditional democratic institutions were just outdated. They were no longer relevant in the modern era. So that first transformation is, taking on board the critique of the market, but responding to it through a faith in expertise. The second transformation then happens later in the 20th century with the resurgence of laissez-faire, neoliberal critiques from Hayek and Friedman, and that whole law and economics move that emerges in the 70s and 80s. That critique is really built to take down the New Deal state. And a central part of that critique was getting to the heart of the New Deal order's legitimacy, which was this faith in expertise. That whole argument was that we shouldn't have faith in expertise. Regulatory institutions are prone to capture, they're likely to be co-opted and corrupted, and that you need to go back to this classical idea of a self-correcting market.
And that you just can't know, right? Like, the market knows more than any expert ever could.
Right, and this is a key part, I think, of the persuasiveness of that argument, which is that there are very real limits to what, a technocratic institution and individuals can know and can accomplish. So in the face of this resurgent critique, I think progressive politics then goes through a second transformation, which is trying to respond to the neoliberal attack. And I talk about this in the book as technocracy redux. It's instead of sort of taking the critique sort of more seriously, the response is really to double down on a more limited, minimal version of New Deal technocracy. So it's still relying on expertise, still trying to assert the neutrality and the efficacy of expert governance, but narrowing the vision of what expert government is meant to achieve. So where the New Deal had a pretty robust, muscular view of what it was going to deploy the state to do, right, to manage labor relations and to manage the market in a aggressive way, the late 20th century response to the neoliberal critique essentially took a lot of free market views on board and said that, look, we're still going to rely on expertise because they're more trustworthy than messy democratic politics. But we're just going to we're not going to go quite as far. Right. We're going to rely more on, public-private partnerships, market mechanisms, cost-benefit analysis. And you see this in the political thought, but also really in the practice of the administrative state of regulatory policy in, say, the Clinton era, for example.
And you argue that any sense of power gets lost along the way.
Right.
Hence tradition. Democracy against domination. You see how it all fits together.
Right. I'm not one who's generally good with titles, mm-hmm. but for once in my life, I had a shorter title, which
but
I'm
But I feel
I'm
like you know about. The argument works when the title's easy to come up with.
Yeah, right. It's a good sign. Yeah. But that's exactly right, that the two things that end up getting lost are, first, this focus on domination, that instead of government being directed against economic power, now government is focused on merely optimizing an existing market structure. And instead of democracy, government is doing this project of optimizing through top-down expertise. So we've lost both parts of this kind of nascent democratic vision that was live pre-New Deal by the time you get to the end of the 20th century. And so to me, that sets up then the challenge of 21st century progressive thought, where our default way of thinking about the role of government in the economy is technocratic and minimalist, whereas I would argue that in the face of all the structural changes in our economy, what we really need is a much more robust, moralized view of, you know, policy that counteracts economic power and a deeper commitment to democratic ways of running those government programs.
I always think of, like, this is a minor detail, but I think it's like so revealing of the general mindset that, you know, the West Wing, this quintessential example of late 90s, early aughts American liberal culture, the president's a Nobel Prize winning economist.
Yeah.
Because of course he has to be. He has to be smarter than everyone. He has to embody this ideal. So is the argument that sort of along the way you lose what, even in the New Deal, when you have sort of the flourishing of this like expert-driven state, there's still a sense of a sort of robust public interest that can be appealed to, that by the end of the 20th century, almost like that vision of the public interest, which is keenly attuned to questions of power and domination, is lost to one focused solely on efficiency as your criteria for policy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'd add to the way you framed it an additional gloss, which is, you know, I think especially in the latter half of the 20th century, liberals in part became enamored of the idea of growth and efficiency and the idea of expertise as an attempt to bypass some of the more controversial normative questions that arise when you're engaging with, say, redistribution or problems of power. Those are messy questions that are fundamentally normative, right? And it's hard to sort of draw those lines in a neat way. And so I think the idea of growth, efficiency, expertise seemed to offer a kind of safe haven for progressive politics, right? The idea was that, you know, these are neutral, they're objective. We can win over skeptical, you know, skeptics of government by appealing to this way of thinking about public policy, which, you know, when I was working on the book, struck me as problematic and you know, I think increasingly so, given everything that's been developing in public politics today.
Well, so thinking about, like, again, this book, it starts with Barack Obama. Is one of the arguments here that Obama, in a sense, he ran as a Democrat and governed as an expert or this managerial technocrat?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And there are a lot of things that I support and appreciate about the Obama administration. But I think one of the things that's really clear to me about looking at it over the course of its duration is that it had a very thin notion of what democracy means and what democracy could mean. So even in his campaign,
Peter Orszag's not exactly the guy you go to for Dewey readings.
Totally. Well, and even Obama, right? If you look at the one of the reasons why I start with that that image of his speech after the Iowa caucus, right? He talks about sort of the democracy as the collective project of making a better society, of doing so by linking arms with one another, right? That we have to do this collectively. We can't do it, accomplish this individually. I think that's really powerful, but I think it's telling that it's indicative of how much intellectual capital, so to speak, had faded away over the course of that sort of long arc that we were talking about a minute ago, that the best sort of idea of democracy that we could come up with at that moment of the financial crisis, where it seemed like there was a lot of room to put forward a new vision of what government is. The best we could come up with was democracy as elections and democracy as sort of cooperation across different parties, you know, bipartisan cooperation in Washington. You know, but of course it's much more, real democracy is much more than that.
It does almost seem like in retrospect that Democrats papered over the sort of absence of a robust like theory of politics and democracy by either circling around charismatic figures like FDR, JFK, Obama, appealing to the authority of experts in the way that you cite, or piggybacking off of the moral energy of reform movements like the civil rights movement. And somehow, like, that's a way to like patch it through, but somehow this like deeper prospect got lost along the way.
Right. I think that's totally right. And so one of the things I talk about in the book, just as an example, right, in the battle over the Dodd-Frank reform bill.
I was going to ask you, yes, yeah. So this is a perfect example of this program in action, or sort of like how, so it's like what actually happened with Obama and what your alternative, a Democratic alternative, would look
like. Right, totally. So in 2010, you know, it's been a couple years, and Obama goes, I think I talk about this in the book, he goes to the Cooper Union, you know, right a few blocks from here in New York, and he gives a speech, sort of make or break speech, defending his Wall Street reform package. And outside there are all these protesters, right, who are exercised about inequality, about the problem of finance. You know, they want these Wall Street CEOs to go to jail, right, for causing the financial crisis. Inside the room, those same CEOs are sitting in the front row. And Obama makes his pitch, and his pitch is basically a New Deal-style pitch where it's that, look, the problem, in his view, the problem of the financial crisis was really one of risk management, that our models of and governance institutions of managing the financial, you know, complex financial products was just not sophisticated enough. And so we needed to give more resources and authority to the Fed, for example, to manage systemic risk. So that's one model. But I think there were counter voices at the same time. You know, then professor, not yet Senator Elizabeth Warren is the example I talk about in the book, where, you know, in some ways she has also presented herself as an expert, you know, policy wonk. But I think a better way to understand her appeal then and now is she was channeling a kind of small d democratic critique of financial power, not just inefficiency and growth problems, but that this is a problem of power and accountability that was lacking in the financial sector, and this idea of small d democracy, that our response to power is to hold it accountable to the democratic public in some form. And you know what we got with the Wall Street reform package was more of the technocratic mode, but I think the fact that it has continued to be so controversial and on both left and right is indicative that it was missing something really real about the about what was morally troubling about the financial
crisis. So the argument is that financial reform created more efficient financial institutions that might be less prone to the type of disasters that we encountered in 2008,
right,
but that the power of the financial industry itself was left untouched.
Yeah, right. And you know, I think we can see that empirically, that, you know, too big to fail financial institutions are very much still among us. In theory, they're being managed from above by the Fed. But, you know, some of the more radical proposals at the time were to kind of like an antitrust style break up the banks, or to reinstate Glass-Steagall, or to do a bunch of sort of much more aggressive structural things that would have limited the power of financial firms. And to my mind, that's much more in the spirit of the anti-domination sort of way of thinking about economic power.
So you finished this book before the Sanders campaign really got going, right?
Yeah.
So what was it like? How much resonance do you see between the platform you are outlining here and what was on the campaign trail earlier this year?
A lot of resonance. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, academic books are in theory meant to operate on a longer time horizon. You know, and the books don't really end, right? They just stop when you can't push the deadline.
Yeah, when you have to turn it in finally.
So you know,
deadlines are liberating that way.
Deadlines are liberating that way, and you know, the manuscript shipped, and then the 2016 campaign really got underway.
And then American politics exploded.
Absolutely. And you know, I think in a lot of ways, what we're grappling with now and over the last 12 months, to me is in line with what I'm arguing in the book. I mean, in a lot of ways, the book at its core is a critique of this liberal managerial notion and a warning that we need to recover a more power-oriented critique of markets and a more small-d democratic way of governing. I think, you know, one way to read the sort of emergence of the Sanders-Warren wing of the Democratic Party is, I think, trying to operate in this spirit. And in some ways, the fact that sort of we needed that political entrepreneurship, to if I can use that term, sort of speaks to just how dormant this way of thinking has been, but also how critical it is for the kinds of economic upheavals, anxieties that we feel, you know, in this start of the 21st century. So in that sense, I think the battle within progressive politics that has been going on for the last year and a half was really already underway in 08, 09, 2010, the period that I mainly focus on in the book, in the policy chapters of the book. So that part, I think, has been vindicated. The other part that I think really, for me, I've been thinking about a lot, you know, now that this election is...
Yeah, and to be clear, we're having this conversation in the aftermath of the presidential election.
Right. So, you know, and obviously there are a lot of things to unpack about that. But, you know, one of the subtexts of the book, or of the argument in the book for me, is that in moments of economic upheaval and societal transformation, things kind of become suddenly up for grabs. Like deep commitments about our understanding of government, of markets, and sort of our moral understandings of what this is all about are suddenly sort of open to revision, open to reinterpretation. And in those moments of flux, in the absence of a morally compelling progressive populism, other things fill that void.
Yeah, either you clean the wound or it gets infected.
Yeah, right. And I think there's a real way to sort of see the Trump phenomenon as an example of a kind of right-wing populism that is speaking to some of the same root concerns about, you know, a government that seems not democratic, not responsive, alienated from we the people, an economy that seems rigged and that doesn't seem to work for us as a collective, right? But gives a very different answer to what that problem is. And so I actually conclude in the book, in the closing pages, I reference this worry that in the absence of a progressive populist vision of the kind that I'm trying to get at in the book, what you could get is sort of exclusionary populisms where the solution is to offer a much more truncated view of who the people are and to sort of present that as a solution to this problem of disempowerment.
One reason why it's so great to have this conversation with you right now is not just have you written this fantastic book, but you also have sort of a foot in this other world that you're involved with the Roosevelt Institute. You sort of know that like DC policy wonk community really well, and it comes through in the book. That's one reason, again, why it's so valuable, sort of the mingling of different perspectives, like the legal, the political, theoretical, the historical, and the practical. So with that in mind, how do you think the sort of DC policy wonk liberal community is going to respond to this Trump, from their perspective, this disaster that they basically did not see coming?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, understandably, a lot of soul searching happening in a lot of different sort of progressive liberal communities. So I think there are actually, a couple of fault lines that are emerging and they're going to have to be grappled with. One that is very clear is sort of you alluded to the argument raised by Sanders in his primary challenge, right? This idea that we really do have to rethink the sort of mainstream liberal acceptance of market dynamics, of economic growth, of efficiency, and recover a language of economic power. Right? There are very real ways in which, whether it's finance or the resurgence of new monopolies in all sorts of industries, there's a real way in which power is what's skewing the economy, keeping it from working for the bulk of communities. So I think that fault line is very much there. I think the other fault line is really brought to the fore out of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is this gets to this question of inclusion and exclusion. That, you know, what are the ways in which our polity has tended to create structural forms of racial exclusion? You know, even at its height, the New Deal was premised on sort of a presumption of who's included in the social contract and who's not. And
yeah, it doesn't get passed without the backing of Southern segregationist legislators.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, a lot of the ferment that's happening after the election that frankly had been happening through much of this last year, even over the course of the campaign, is these two tensions in parallel. And coming out of this election, I think the real challenge for progressive politics is to understand and figure out how to synthesize or fuse these two critiques, the structural economic critique of how the ways in which power is operating in the market and the structural racial critique of how many of those dynamics are themselves racialized. That's a difficult, you know, needle to thread. The New Deal certainly did not pull that off at all, didn't really try to do so.
But it also didn't have to, right? Because it was responding to different political pressures. When Black people can't vote in the South, you don't have to appeal to their votes. The Democratic Party in 2016 is facing very different
coalition. Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things I've been fascinated by, I talk about it a little less in the book, but I've been sort of exploring a little bit more lately, is this question of, you know, there are certain moments historically, right, where radical racial justice movements were fusing with radical economic justice movements. And so, you know, certain moments in the early labor Republican movement of the late 19th century, you know, you have some brief moments where kind of people coming out of the abolition movement are connecting with people in labor and populism sort of in that late 19th century. And then in civil rights, you know, we often sort of downplay the structural economic critique that was embedded in the civil rights movement and its successor welfare rights movement.
Or the close relationship between civil rights activists and union leaders. Right. Like, not all union members were engaged in the cause, but there were actually, like, especially at the top levels, like, quite close connections, including financial funding. Like,
totally. Because... yeah. And I think that's a great point. And so to my mind, part of the way forward is, you know, kind of recovering that tradition as well, of where those moments where racial justice and economic justice have been in conversation with one another and started to sort of inform one another, improve one another.
You've been really generous with your time, but before I let you go, just sort of a few questions stepping back from thinking about the present from that more theoretical perspective, abstracting a little bit. So we've discussed this sort of like laissez-faire tradition, this expert-driven tradition, this democratic tradition, but at a moment when Bernie Sanders is trying to like legitimize the place of socialism in the public sphere, a concept that doesn't really break through into the book that much is Marxism. And I was wondering where you would, how that would fit into the story you're telling here, if not as a live political tradition in the United States, then as an analytic that might be useful in the years ahead and might be useful for interpreting the history that you present.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, so I think it connects in a couple of different ways. First, it maybe connects as a little bit as subtext, right? You know, certainly for someone like Dewey, you know, writing at the time is very much responding to or in dialogue with sort of socialist counterparts in Europe, and they're all kind of trying to think through these questions together and in response to one another. And I think part of my approach in the book was to self-consciously try to root this in a distinctively American tradition of political economy. So, I deliberately wanted to focus on folks like Brandeis, folks like Dewey, sort of the American tradition of democratic.
Which Sanders did as well, right? He just went to Debs instead of Brandeis and Dewey, but it was Debs and FDR as the roots of democratic socialism.
Totally right, and I think, but I think that's a little bit telling too, because I think unlike say Debs and FDR, I think the Deweyan and Brandeisian version of this is perhaps a little bit more oriented towards small d democracy, right? Because I do think that a big part of it for us has to be finding ways to make government genuinely democratic, genuinely participatory, genuinely of, for, and by the people. And that's not in tension necessarily with sort of other analytical traditions in socialism and Marxism, but I think it's much more distinctive about sort of American radicalism, which I quite like and am drawn to. In terms of sort of conceptually or analytically, you know, absolutely there are connections in terms of the critique of economic power, this idea that the market is a structure that is a product of law and politics that serves particular interests and needs to be sort of the control of which needs to be wrested back. I think there are all sorts of connections, you know, intellectually, but I did want to root it in a distinctively American tradition.
And this question of sort of how to make this regulatory apparatus, like, actually not just like democratically accountable, but feel like a part of democratic life, it's a key theme in the book, and it's obviously a question that anyone with like your type of concerns like has to face head on. I just wonder, though, after sort of like the grim testimony to the state of American democracy, at least from my perspective, provided by like this week's returns, how much faith you have that it was Bertrand Russell who said that like the problem with democracy was that it takes up too many weekdays or like weeknights, right? That's sort of how to make these institutions more than just like maybe one reason why they become the province of technocrats is technocrats are the only ones who can get excited about them and invest in them. So if you could just talk like briefly about making those connections something that could actually have meaning as opposed to like well-intentioned but ultimately ineffectual gestures.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that question because, you know, one of the big parts of the book is an attempt to get kind of into the weeds in a lot of ways about how our regulatory institutions are designed. So I do kind of get into the nuts and bolts to try to think about how we can do actually day-to-day public policy governance in a way that's more participatory and democratic. But the reason I think that's critical is the answer to your question, which is that I think a lot of what we think of sort of in the vernacular as failures of democracy are actually failures of insufficient democracy. So, you know, we're so used to such a limited idea of what we as citizens are supposed to do and are empowered to do. All we have are elections and sort of public opinions and so on. And that's democracy. But I think the problem with that is that it's doesn't speak to this deeper moral concern about empowerment or disempowerment. The world is complicated. People rightly feel alienated from these broad economic and political structures that, you know, shape their life prospects, but over which they have no control. And I think it's sort of on us to create, invest in those institutions and practices that can make democracy more of a day-to-day lived experience. And I think that's how we get around some of these more problematic pathologies of, you know, the pathologies of what we think of arising from democracy are really arising from, you know, the fact that it's not really truly democratic. And these instances of popular sovereignty are so few and far between, when really I'd like to see it as more of a day-to-day ordinary occurrence. And I should say, I mentioned a little bit in the book that if we're going to pull that off, that itself is a large project. It means designing our institutions very differently, in a more participatory way. It means investing in sort of civil society and organizing, whether it's through labor or other kinds of community-based organizations that give people a sense of belonging and empowerment and an ability to plug into public policy. It means there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. But I think that's the debate we need to have. That's the challenge we need to take on. And the longer we sort of fool ourselves into thinking that we can get by just by leaving democracy in its emaciated form and just trying to do the public's business through top-down technocratic means, we're going to fall further and further behind as a progressive movement.
Thinking about how we get to there from here,
yep.
Which is, you know, it's for a book that, as you say, like it focuses on lived political experience. It wants to connect issues of policy, issues of theory, issues of history to the facts on the ground in a deep way. And I think it succeeds like remarkably in that respect. But thinking about the state of American democracy today, I think it's fair to say that people are not just like more divided,
yeah.
But tensions, emotions, like hatreds are running higher than at any time, at least in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
And now in a moment where you have both politics is more partisan than ever, but now it's divided along like racial lines,
yeah.
in a distinct way, sort of like white nationalism moving into the foreground of American politics in a way that it hasn't in decades. Having trouble phrasing it because it's such a tough question to ask, and it may be an impossible one to answer, but you wrote the book, so you have to deal with it. how do you develop a vision that can like respond to those concerns? And more to the point, like, do you think it's possible, or have things just like curdled so much that the moment for this might have passed?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great question, and I mean, I think many of us are struggling to figure out where we go from here after this election and after the ugliness of the campaign, which I think, you know, will really have repercussions for that extend much beyond, you know, the election itself. I think I share a lot of those fears. I think I'm an optimist at heart. Like, I think there's a way forward, you know, but I think these things operate not on 4-year cycles, but on 5, 10, 15-year time horizons. And, you know, when I started writing the book, that was sort of in the back of my mind, right, to try to start contributing to a long time horizon conversation about the core of the moral core of what progressivism ought to be. And I think that still holds. So I think, you know, going forward, I think of the future of the progressive movement after this election as requiring three things. It's the first is a deep commitment to economic inclusion that takes the problems of domination seriously. And so that means, you know, getting past our sort of predilection for liberal wonkery, right, and getting into some of these like really moral, foregrounding some of these moral questions about private power, and economic injustice. That, I think, we see that debate already underway in since the election among a lot of progressives. The second thing we need is a commitment to the idea of democracy, that we want to solve these problems not by delegating them to experts on high, but by empowering we the people to connect with these questions. And I think you see a lot of that too, even in these last these early few days since the election. The third thing is then to do all this in a way that can deepen and reassert our commitment to inclusion, right? To counteract sort of racial and xenophobic worst fears that this election has raised on a number of dimensions. And, you know, that's really hard. I think that's where it gets really, really tough. I don't know if I have a long-term sort of answer or game plan to that, but I my hope is that by taking these questions head on and addressing them sort of as fundamental moral questions, not just technical policy questions, we can get a bit further towards, you know, a kind of new progressive synthesis. It's going to take a lot of time, but you know, I'm hopeful that we can do it. And actually, I'll add one more thing, which I don't talk about as much in the book, but has been on my mind since the election. You know, we're in another moment of economic transformation, much like in the response to industrialization. And what's possibly transformative about that is, when I think about the movements and communities and constituencies that are doing some of the best rethinking of what an inclusive economy looks like and what a democratic polity looks like, what's interesting to me about it is there are these interesting alliances, so to speak, between communities of color and workers of different stripes. And so, you know, the domestic workers who are largely women of color, you know, are advancing a critique of what the new social safety net needs to look like. Their ideas actually work really well for workers of all stripes. And so there is universality embedded in some of these, some of the critiques emerging from particular constituencies and communities. And I think, there's room for us to grow out of those critiques and build something more more lasting and inclusive.
One very last question, which just emerges, maybe less from optimism than from Schadenfreude. What do you think happens to the liberal experts after this week?
Well, the liberal expertise in managerialism
seems like they've had a tough time.
They've had a tough time, but you know, they're also remarkably resilient, right? This is sort of we just cannot get over our fascination with technocracy. I don't know what's going to happen. What I would like to see happen is, you know, a little bit of humility about, you know, liberal wonkery, right? Maybe we can't figure it all out just by putting smart people in a room, and maybe we ought not to just rely on that particular, you know, mechanism. I think that some of the bottom-up pressures that are emerging on the left, you know, from the Sanders Warren critique, from the Movement for Black Lives critique, to name just two, I think those are really starting to flip the order of priority, where instead of, you know, the expert wonks setting the table and then other people sort of following along, we're sort of subordinating expertise to serve the moral ends of these critiques, which is actually what Dewey had in mind, right? Dewey says that he's not saying expertise is bad or wrong. He wants expertise, but he says expertise should be deployed to sort of figure out how to achieve the ends that the democratic polity decides, right? And so, yeah, we you know, I want experts to figure out how to break up the banks and solve monopoly power and solve structural racism. That's going to require expertise, but it's in a different sort of order of priority.
The book is Democracy Against Domination. Sabeel Rahman, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Tim. This was great.